Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
It is now said, John, that the traffic across America has almost come to a standstill during the pandemic. I mean, can you imagine you and I going down I-95, cruising into New York City on a Wednesday morning? I would never do that during the week in normal times. It's just too nerve-wracking.
Well, I was watching a show on TV, and a guy was on his motorcycle. I forget what show it was now, but he's driving down Rodeo Drive in L.A., and there's nothing. There's nobody around.
Nobody shopping?
It's a ghost town. No.
Really?
Yeah.
Gee, I could finally pick up that purse for my wife. It must be on sale for 80% off. Well, with all that said, though, gridlock is a really serious problem in America. There's no question about it. And, in fact, I read this piece in the New York Post, Nicole Gelinas, and she's also with the Manhattan Institute. We've had guests on. We have guests from liberal think tanks, from more moderate, more conservative, libertarian. I mean, we try to bring you a lot of different thought processes. But let me just read a little bit from Nicole's piece. Kobe Bryant died because Los Angeles has become a traffic hellscape, she said. Now, I never really thought about that at the beginning, because he died on a Sunday morning. But he had gone out to get his own valet, chaperoned helicopter, because he wanted to avoid the traffic that is daily an annoyance or worse in Los Angeles. And so now they're finding that there's a lot of traffic in the skies that may cause more of these kinds of terrible incidents that we saw several months ago with him and his daughter and others who were killed.
Well, unfortunately for Kobe, the pilot never should have taken off in that weather, but you're right. There's more stuff in the skies than ever. You know, we got drones, we got different type of aircraft. So this is a problem. This is,
The average person, John, who commutes in Los Angeles, guess how much time they spend on the roads in traffic every year?
Oh, I can't even.
I know, it's hard, but 119 hours, about three full work weeks in a car.
Wow, you waste that much time just sitting in your car.
And let's be honest, we've been talking about an infrastructure bill. Whenever I go into New York, John, if we do drive, and it's rare that we do, though again, a lot of people are rethinking all of their travel patterns about public transportation now. I was supposed to go into New York City. I canceled that appointment recently, but I am picking it up in July. But how will I want to travel into the city then?
Yeah.
But a lot of people are looking and saying, well, if I'm on this train, are they really spending the time to disinfect it?
I know in the past they were pretty grubby, those cars you got on those trains.
Well, imagine the subways. For the first time in history, they've closed them down between 1 and 5 in the morning. Yeah. But the first person who gets on, if they have germs and they're carrying or they're shedding, I love that, they're shedding. You're shedding virus. No, but think about it.
That's just my hair.
Oh, yeah, well, maybe both. But, John, if they are shedding virus, the first person who comes on, all that cleaning overnight.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to know what to do.
It really, really is. But with all that said, up until now, We have seen cities in lockdown virtually, like Atlanta. Pick your favorite or your unfavorite, Los Angeles. Yeah. People talk about other places all across America saying it's getting more difficult every day to get to work. So now, of course, maybe that begins to change, not because we've had an infrastructure bill, but because a lot of people are going to be telecommuting. Right. I know in our state of Connecticut, we're seeing an influx of people who are moving back to Fairfield County from New York already during this pandemic with all the uncertainties about jobs and futures and everything else, because they want a little backyard and because they realize that they can take the train in, but maybe it's only twice a week or three times, and they work out of the house the remainder of the time.
Well, the ironic part about that, though, is my brother-in-law has two teachers in the house, right? So they're video teaching, and the with everybody home, the internet connection sometimes runs a little too slow.
That's a big issue, John. So now the highway that's clogged is the digital highway, and we're going to have to speed that up. No, there's no question about it. There's so many offshoots to this. But gridlock is not only in New York or L.A., believe me. You're finding states like South Carolina, Florida, with these booming populations clogging the roads. Funding for mass transit has not kept up with population growth. And you've got all kinds of things going on. So please be reminded that we had this conversation right at the beginning of the coronavirus epidemic. Maybe in the short term, some of the things we talk about have been alleviated only because of the crisis. But I would imagine a lot of them will be back shortly thereafter.
Oh, yeah.
I would imagine.
Well, we still have to deal with our infrastructure. I mean, it's just too old and it hasn't been maintained. I mean, we got big problems in a lot of the cities with the.
And you may be surprised that Nicole really does think that New York City has dealt successfully with many of the challenges that dogged it in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. But the one remaining existential threat to its success going forward to New York, if you take out crime and you take out a lot of the things, is traffic. And that might be the final straw. Maybe certain people say, well, this higher density, this fact that I can't get away from other people. But now, when you think about the commuting aspect of this coming back and having to deal with it when you haven't dealt with it now for a couple of months, that might be it.
Right.
That might push the button. So, anyway, come to Connecticut. That's what we say, John. And bring your tax dollars with you, because we need all of them.
You're going to need it.
Absolutely. Well, here we are. Let's talk about gridlock, or the lack thereof for the moment, and the return of it in the future. Coming soon to a road near you.
With me on America Trends is Nicole Gelinas of the Manhattan Institute. She's a senior fellow and contributing editor to the City Journal, which is published by the Manhattan Institute. And you might also read her columns often in the New York Post. And there was one column about traffic gridlock, how traffic is ruining people's lives, as it was excerpted in the Week publication. And Nicole, it got a lot of attention. And I think it got a lot of attention because a lot of people understand how vexing this issue is. But you certainly help us to break it down. It's not just a matter of inconvenience, is it, any longer?
Yes, and first of all, Larry, thank you for having me on. I'm honored to be on the podcast. And no, it's not a matter of inconvenience. We have 35,000 people dying every year in traffic crashes. If you look at how Kobe Bryant, the basketball star, and his daughter died, they basically died in a traffic crash. They died trying to avoid Los Angeles, Southern California traffic. And so we do have a serious both quality of life problem every day when people are losing hours of their lives to sitting in traffic, and also just a basic life safety problem that unless you're really living in the edge and doing all kinds of stunts and skydiving and everything, the most dangerous thing you do every day is get in a car or put your children in a car.
By the way, when you mentioned about Kobe Bryant in your piece, and you talked about the hellscape that he was trying to get over and avoid, and you mentioned that there's even traffic that's beginning to emerge over the skies of these urban areas, where we could see something even as tragic as what happened to those nine people happen again.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, Kobe Bryant, the pilot, and seven other individuals were stuck in helicopter traffic. I mean, they were trying to avoid the traffic on the ground, got up there for what's supposed to be a short flight, and they were put into a holding pattern because they had to wait for small planes to land at one of the airports. And so, beginning of the automobile age, the roads became very quickly clogged up with cars and trucks, and it's always been a fantasy that people could escape these crowded roads by taking to the air. If you look at the Jetsons in the 1950s, if you go even further back than that to the 1920s, 1930s, people were drawing cartoons and sort of envisioning a life where we'd all be flying in these little air pods, but that is highly unrealistic. The best way to avoid traffic is still what it always has been, is using the methods of transportation that predate the automobile, subways, buses. People used to walk to work in late 19th century, early 20th century urban America. Very common to have factories located very close to people's homes, so they didn't have to worry about spending hours a day devoted to just getting from one place to another.
I remember, of course, even in the city where I grew up, that these big factories that were there at the time, they provided housing for their workers. So we're a long distance from where we were. Now, you remind us in your piece that across the country, the average commuter is wasting 54 hours a year due to traffic delays. In comparison, when we're looking at the problem in Los Angeles, that's 119 hours. How do we measure frustration, anxiety, lost productivity? Because we all bemoan it, we all talk about it, but there are very few cities, I think, that have conquered it, and it's getting worse. In fact, L.A. isn't even in the worst. The recent ranking put Boston on the top of the worst. But then again, I think Atlanta, New York, and others would cry out that they're worse.
Yeah, I mean, in that 54-hour figure that you mentioned, that is way up over the past 40 years. I mean, people were only spending 20 hours a year delayed in traffic in 1982, and so it's obviously more than doubled and close to tripled over this almost 40-year period. And, people used to say, well, L.A. is sort of like a special case. It's kind of like this dystopia that they've created for themselves, but more and more cities have become like L.A. Like, if you're trying to get from, the Boston Globe did a whole series on this earlier this year, but if you're trying to get from suburban Boston into the city, or just going from one suburb to another, which is how a lot of people commute today. Like, if you think about the Route 128 corridor in Boston, mm-hmm. A lot of tech-heavy suburban office parks and the kind of affluent suburbs where a lot of these people live, these roads going back and forth among the suburbs are just clogged up, multiple hours out of the day. It's not like, oh, you can just avoid leaving at 8:20 in the morning. You go at 7, you go at 10 o'clock, and these streets are still crowded. And so, what do we do? I think one of the answers is, what do we not do? a lot of people 10 years ago were saying, oh, we're all going to be in Ubers, we're going to be sharing cars, we won't own our own car. But that doesn't matter if you're still on the road just as many hours and miles, whether you own your own car or not. And we've seen many studies by this point that show that Uber and Lyft have only added to the gridlock problem by making it easier for people who were taking subways and buses to just sort of hail a car on their phone instead. So I think we're not going to build our way out of this with more highways and more roads. I think even people in places like California have realized you build a road, it just gets quickly filled up with more cars. I think we need to think about changing how we live and living in denser environments. Not everyone's going to get an acre for a single-family house and three cars in the garage. much more densely built communities that are served by mass transit, both subway and bus transit. And, you know, to some extent, another thing they're doing is just, you know, we see this with the coronavirus, is people working more at home. You know, even if you don't work 5 days a week at home, maybe you work 2 days a week in the office and have your meetings on those 2 days, and then work the other days at home. And that's another way of...
Yeah, and ironically, this as a test case may result in more people saying, gee, I can do this. I never thought it was going to be practical. Let me ask you, in the same article, you discussed failing public infrastructure. And each year, the American Society of Civil Engineers does this report. I'm sure you're very familiar with it, on American infrastructure. And they include roads, water, dams, airports, everything. And overall, we get a D plus. And surface transportation is right at the top of the list for the need related to investment, far distancing the next area, which is the electrical grid. Overall, transportation got a D minus. Do you think that's deserved?
Yeah, I think it's deserved in the fact that we have not spent enough money to keep up with population growth and with just the, you know, things like more women in the workplace. And so you have a lot more people commuting back and forth than you did, say, in the early 1970s. But it's not only that we don't spend enough money, we don't spend the money very wisely. I mean, if you think about New York City, for example, we desperately need more subway capacity. You know, we have a record population of 8.5 million people. We have a record number of jobs. When we don't have the coronavirus, we have a record number of tourists, you know, 65 million people coming to visit us every year. But we've only built 4 subway stops in the past half century. We built the 3 subway stops of the Second Avenue subway, and we built 1 stop on the far west side of Manhattan. I mean, we've been talking about building a full Second Avenue subway that would be closer to 15 stops going from the Bronx, the northern Manhattan, to Brooklyn, southeastern Manhattan. We've been talking about that for 100 years, but all we've been able to accomplish is getting 3 stops of it built. And it's not really a lack of money. I mean, New York is one of the richest cities in the world. We have plenty of money for transit. We've just spent that a lot of that money very unwisely.
Well, I'd like to focus in a little bit on New York, because we can't look at circumstances in every community in America, though this podcast, of course, is meant for everyone to consume wherever they are. But let's take New York as a case study. In a piece that you did in the City Journal, you say the problem is legendary. You suggest in that piece that while New York has dealt successfully with many other challenges that have dogged it for many years in the 70s, the 80s, and the early 90s, the one remaining existential threat to its success is traffic. And I know you've had some brilliant thinkers there. Gridlock Sam, I did a podcast with him about driverless cars. Sam Schwartz, and you talked to him for this article. I mean, you've got a lot of great engineers and traffic engineers, people thinking about this. And there have been changes, of course. I remember when Mike Bloomberg took Broadway out of play, a certain portion of it, to cars, and he was trying to make it more pedestrian-friendly. I mean, how much thinking is going on every day in New York City about what to do about this problem?
Oh, we have a lot of thinking. It's just, it's hard to get a lot of that thinking executed. And, you know, on the good news side, New York, the streets are a lot different than they were, say, 20 years ago. Well, we've nodded to the fact that most people are not getting around in cars. I mean, if you look at, you know, there's an organization called the New York Metropolitan Transportation Council. They put out statistics every year. Every day of the number of people who come into Manhattan from New Jersey, from Westchester, Long Island suburbs, from the outer boroughs to work, more than 3/4 of them come in on public transportation. They don't come in a private car. And the reasons for that are easy. There's just no room for the private cars on the streets of Manhattan. I mean, the number of cars in Manhattan by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon it's what's known as saturated, so you start to see on crosstown streets the traffic is backed up. People can't, you can't fit any more cars on the crosstown streets. That starts to back up the avenues as cars and car and truck drivers are waiting to turn onto the crosstown streets. So people have kind of figured out on their own it's not a very good idea to drive into the city unless you absolutely have to. And it's also expensive. I mean, it's expensive to park, and a lot of the crossings are toll crossings, so you're paying to pay the toll. And we're also starting congestion pricing at some point in the next, hopefully next few months, definitely in the next few years. So that.
Well, I want to talk about that, because you say that that is one of a threefold solution. This congestion pricing, how much has this been thought about for how long in New York, and is it being attempted around the country? I know I live in Connecticut. We've talked about it, particularly on I-95, but we've done nothing about it thus far.
Yeah, we've been talking about congestion pricing since at least the 1950s, you know, when the New York City transit system started to run into problems during the Robert Moses era. The federal money, state money was directed to highways. People still kind of thought that highways were the future. The transit authority was failing. And, well, it wasn't even authority back then. The city ran the transit system. And, you know, there were bright thinkers who said, let's toll the free East River bridges. We'll put a toll on the Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan Bridge, and use that money to fund transit. But it's always, you know, it's always been an idea whose time has never come. And last year, perhaps, its time finally came when the state legislature approved a plan to charge people to come in to core Manhattan, probably, you know, $12, $15 a year for a car. And that money, about $1.5 billion a year, will go to fund the transit system. The problem is it's being held up right now, you know, perhaps by the Trump administration, perhaps just by the MTA itself. It's not really clear, but it was supposed to start in January. We may not get it until well after January. But other ways in which the streets are different, we started to build more space on the streets for pedestrians and bicyclists, you know, mm-hmm. starting under the Bloomberg era, so, you know, the first decade of the 2000s, you know, 2008, 2009, the city made much of Times Square into a pedestrian plaza, added protected bike lanes on some of the major thoroughfares. And that just, you know, at the time, it was received as kind of a radical change. You know, Donald Trump went on David Letterman and said they've ruined Times Square. But it's just a nod to the fact that you could have 500,000 people walking through Times Square on a busy day. They just, you know, if you go out there after a Broadway show gets out, even with the pedestrian plazas, there's just not enough money for everyone to walk around. I mean, we have pedestrian congestion.
It's so interesting when I think about New York, because there are so many people, including my son and his wife, living on the Lower East Side. They don't own a car. They would not even think about having a car. And yet, somehow, cars find their way into the city in dramatic fashion, even though people like me who come in from the suburbs will never drive in unless I have to. I mean, periodically, I will take the MTA. But then, of course, you've got the greatest subway system, or the most utilized one, even though it hasn't grown in the ways that it needs to. But you also have these delivery trucks today, because if you don't have a car, now you're having everything delivered to your home. I can't even imagine what that's doing to the streets on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's a big problem. I mean, we have UPS, FedEx, DHL, all of these kind of small startup companies now that work with Amazon, work with Walmart. And so that is adding to the curbside traffic. And I think some of that, a good congestion pricing system where these delivery trucks aren't just paid to come in across the Manhattan line and then they can ride around all day, but they're paid more like for the amount of time that they're idling on the curb. So more like if you were sitting in a taxi, you know, you're paying by the minute, because at some point these companies will have to pass that down to the customers. And so if it costs more to have a package delivered, maybe you just go downstairs and go to the drugstore. I mean, that was one of the whole points of living in an urban environment. And the other part of the delivery issue is the delivery bicyclist. You know, we have more and more people getting food delivered to themselves from restaurants. Most of those delivery men, and they are mostly men, are immigrants who are riding around on bicycles because it's the fastest way to get around. And sometimes you'll hear complaints that, oh, the only people I see in the bike lane are the food delivery people. But, I mean, that's commerce. I mean, there's almost nobody driving, bicycling, or walking around in New York City unless they have some kind of commercial reason for doing so. So, you know, that's how people have chosen to live, at least for the moment. And so at least some of the delivery business is on bicycles, not in cars. We may see more of that on the package delivery side, too, with more and more cargo bikes.
Oh, I can only imagine what that looks like.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute is with us. So we talked about congestion pricing. You'd also like to continue to see this redesign of streets to encourage more bus use and cycling. Oh, by the way, before we forget about it, what about buses? I mean, how practical are they today in many of these major cities? Are they taking a lot of the load? I mean, instead of having one person in or two people in a car, you've got, you know, 100 people on a bus. But, I mean, we don't talk about them very often, but they are clearly an important mode of transportation still on our roads.
Oh, yes, and for many cities that don't have a subway system, buses are just the most efficient way of creating mass transportation. You know, Houston redesigned its bus system, and more people are taking the bus. One of the problems, though, is that buses get stuck in the same traffic as everybody else, so it doesn't make a lot of sense to sit on a bus if you're just going to be sitting behind a car. And so we need more dedicated bus lanes. We should think about bus-only lanes on crowded highways. We have some bus lanes in New York City, but they're not enforced very well. But you're only going to get people on a bus. You know, in most of the country, unfortunately, you only take a bus if you're poor, if you can't afford to drive a car. And that's good that we have bus service for poor people. I mean, this is a way to get people to work, get people into the workforce, get people to school. But the only way you make the bus an option for people who have a car is frequent service. No one wants to stand out on the curb waiting for the bus for half an hour. You know, again, that's only something that you'll do if you have no other choice. And making it faster than the car. So, you know, if you have a fast, reliable, frequent bus that you know is going to be at the corner of the major avenue closest to you every 10 minutes, maybe you think about taking the bus into the city rather than getting into your car.
The third thing that you offered in your piece was that the state and city must fix mass transit, and you talked about that in relation to New York State and New York City. What is the movement around the country for these mass transit projects, whether they be above ground, below ground? I know in Connecticut we did this fast track that got a lot of people upset because you take a bus to a certain place and then you take this limited rail system into Hartford, and people thought it was a boondoggle, but it's taken people off the roads. But there's always public subsidy for any of these. I mean, you're still subsidizing the subway system in New York to a fairly well. Every one of these systems has to be subsidized.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems, the enduring problems with transit, is that it is more expensive than building and running a road. I mean, we've had this problem in New York. Again, going back to the Robert Moses era, you know, a lot of people think Moses was this terrible villain. He wanted to destroy the neighborhoods, and, you know, he hated transit and everything else. But the reality was he was only doing what the conventional wisdom dictated. It's very difficult up until 1960s, 1970s to find an elected official who said, oh, you know, boy, maybe what Moses is doing is wrong. I mean, the mayors, the governors, federal government, all heavily in favor of building out highway projects. And one of the reasons that he was able to build so many bridges, so many expressways to and from those bridges, is because it was actually profitable. I mean, here's an arm of government that makes a profit. You know, you lay down a road, and you can collect the tolls. Even today, the MTA toll system makes a $2-3 billion profit every single year, and that money goes to the transit system. But in terms of a subway car, you need to make heavy investment in these cars, whereas on the roadside, people buy their own cars. And you need, in New York City, you have to have two people operating every subway train, and people are paid quite well, you know, well into the six figures when you're looking at pension and health care benefits. You don't have that on the roadside. You don't have those operating costs. So on the one hand, the density that transit enables creates great wealth. I mean, you wouldn't have Manhattan skyscrapers, you know, multi-million dollar apartments, tech industry, financial industry here, unless you had the transit system. That's the only thing that makes all this density possible. But on the other hand, it does need heavy subsidies, and so that's a difficult equation for a lot of parts of the country that don't have the wealth that we have.
Absolutely. By the way, what impact does the cost of parking have on driving into the city? Because I know that is a disincentive for me. I mean, now you can find all kinds of deals online and such. But, I mean, is that really a part of the equation? Because you bring in, through your writing, so many interesting things that I don't know whether they're comparable in other places. I think parking is expensive in most urban environments. But you also bring in things like double parking, exemptions for city employees that clog up the streets. I mean, there are so many factors that contribute to the problems that we see today that are really becoming outsized.
Yeah, in New York City, you know, particularly in Manhattan, the cost to park is a huge deterrent to both owning a car and driving your car if you have a car. Like if you want to drive into core Manhattan and park, you're going to be paying, you know, $500-$600 a month for a daytime parking fee. In the outer boroughs and in Manhattan, not in Midtown Manhattan, you can park your car on the street overnight, usually for free, but it's kind of a pain. I mean, you have to find a spot. You can never leave your spot because you'll lose your spot. You have to
And, Nicole, who's good at parallel parking?
Right. So it's not – it's, you know, that's why half of the people don't have a car. But on the other hand, you have to have that transit system. If you didn't have the transit system, they wouldn't have the option not to own a car. And in most of the country, parking is much cheaper. I mean, there's a couple places, you know, it's expensive to park in downtown Boston. It's even expensive to park in places like downtown New Orleans, downtown Detroit, because of the conglomeration of office buildings. But if you're, you know, realistically, if you're driving to a suburban office park, it's free. I mean, most American office parks, shopping malls and everything else have acres and acres of free parking. So, and then, of course, you park for free in your own driveway at home. You know, no one really bothers you. There's plenty of parking. So the idea of getting people to pay a lot of money for parking and then providing them with mass transit, still a big leap in most of the country.
Now, I know in the Northeast, I've experienced a lot of trouble, gridlock, Boston and New York being examples of that. I'm just wondering, though, because I've also experienced it in Atlanta and Dallas, and, you know, some might look at the Northeast and say, well, you were built before the advent of the car, and maybe you just haven't adjusted to it. But I'm really wondering whether in the Sun Belt or in other parts of the country, whether there are many municipalities and regions that have figured this out so much better than others, and what it is about the combination of options they have available that makes it work.
Yeah, I think if you look at who has been successful at this, I mean, places like Paris, where the subway system is much cheaper to take, even in a heavily subsidized subway system like New York, you'll pay about $130 a month for a monthly pass. In Paris, it's more like $75 a month, so much more accessible to low-income people, a much wider and more frequent commuter rail network. It's safe to ride your bicycle into town and around town. And so it's even less sensible to take a car. Same with London, you know, a bus system that works really well. The bus system carries just as many people as the subway, the tube system, and they have congested pricing. So, you know, you really are heavily deterred from driving a car. Amsterdam, you can ride your bike. There's actually bike traffic rather than car traffic there. And a tram system, a public transportation system that works pretty well. So if you look at places that were designed, populated, accessible before the automobile was invented, those are the places that still do the best job of getting people around. Hmm.
What about in the United States? I mean, in places well outside of the eastern seaboard and the like, or the West Coast for that matter?
I don't think you're going to find a lot of places that are that successful at this. I mean, we've seen, you know, after the financial crisis, when a lot of young people couldn't buy cars, they were leaving for the big coastal cities to find better opportunities. A lot of smaller cities, you know, Kansas City, Denver, places were thinking, well, gee, we better build mass transportation. But it's very difficult, you know, when you've built out along the single-family line and you just aren't starting with very much transit. You know, yeah, you can build a couple demonstration corridors, but it's really hard to just redesign a city around mass transit from scratch. And I think you see that in the numbers. I mean, New York is really the only region in the country where the majority of people are taking mass transit. You know, the places that would come the closest would be Chicago, Boston, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, again, places that built out heavy rail transit a long time ago.
And what are the public policy levers that we're talking about here? Taxes, fees, fines, tickets. I know you talked about ticket blitzes in New York, more incentives to ride mass transit, more subsidies. I mean, what are the blend of things that municipalities, given the authority, can do to really try to make a dent when they see that they've got a problem that is not just the peak hour any longer?
Yeah, the cities and states do a lot of things for demonstration that really don't make a big impact, like parking ticket blitzes. You know, every single mayor in New York, going back to at least the 50s, has said we're going to crack down on double parking. That never works. You never have the manpower out there to give out enough tickets to deter the people who are doing this. So I think the sort of ticketing system, the punitive system, of course it's different with a speeding ticket because you're engaging in dangerous behavior. But even a speeding ticket is not going to deter most people. I mean, you might get a speeding ticket if you speed regularly, not all that often. You know, the better systems for speeding and red light running now are the automated systems where you've got a system of cameras, so you have 100% chance of getting a speeding ticket in one particular corridor if you speed. And we see that in New York. The network of speed and red light cameras is kind of cracking down on this behavior. But in general, ticketing people to get out of the congestion crisis rather than the speeding crisis is not going to work. I mean, we really have to just think on the infrastructure side, zoning for denser living, and putting the public investment in. And a lot of that money will have to come from the federal government. You know, at least the one thing I was hoping for when Bloomberg was in the presidential race is we would get a lot more thinking about mass transportation, because it's striking that now both people left on the Democratic side, Biden and Sanders, neither one of them comes from an urban area. Neither one really knows the challenges of building out urban transportation. Ironically, Trump comes from the city but never has shown much interest in mass transit.
Yeah, I mean, are you surprised that a national infrastructure bill, which both parties have talked about, hasn't occurred, or that we may not be taking this moment in time as a way to stimulate the economy by putting people to work by way of construction, particularly on what the civil engineers say is the weakest link in our infrastructure system, that being our roads and our transportation?
Yeah, I think, you know, Trump ran on infrastructure. I mean, I remember sitting in the car, ironically, listening to him on a radio show when he was talking about how terrible the Long Island Railroad was and all of these delays, and when he was president, he was going to fix this. But we never got a serious infrastructure bill out of the first term, at least, of this administration. Unlikely that Congress would cooperate on such a thing this year. So we'll need it eventually, and we also need reforms in the infrastructure bill, you know, reward states for cost-cutting, for being more productive with this infrastructure money. But hopefully something we'll see in the next 4 years, whether under one of the Democratic candidates in a half-Democratic Congress, or a better incentive for the Democrats to cooperate with a second-term Trump, knowing that this is the end of the road for him, so to speak.
The incentives that you talk about is very interesting, because here in Connecticut we had a real bottleneck in the central western part of the state, and a really botched highway project that they put out to bid again, and they gave great incentives to all the private contractors involved to get it done sooner and well, and it did. I mean, it was remarkable, and they saved millions of dollars by virtue of giving those incentives, when I say millions of dollars, I mean basically that people didn't have to sit in traffic again and waste millions of dollars in terms of their own efficiency. And it's really unclogged a bottleneck, and people couldn't believe the efficiency. And I think a lot of people need to understand that we're talking about public-private investment here, because virtually all of the work that gets done on these roads is being done by private contractors.
Yeah, I mean, everyone who builds heavy construction is in the private sector. You know, New York goes out and hires private contractors to build subway projects. You know, most road projects are built the same way. But the private contractor world has a lot of problems. I mean, their multi-employer pension plans are basically bankrupt. You know, we've seen a lot of industries go through bankruptcy of their pension funds. They're basically in that phase right now. So a lot of the money that you're paying for construction projects is going to heavily underfunded pensions. You know, if you're looking at salary and benefits for a construction worker, you might get roughly $50 an hour of straight wage, and then another $50 an hour is going to these basically broke pension funds. So, you know, it goes back to a lot of the general problems in the economy of not putting enough money away for retirement, whether in the public sector, private sector, old-fashioned pensions, or people's new 401k pensions that aren't,
exactly. No, we did another podcast on that with someone from the Brookings Institute. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you in closing, because, Nicole, you've given us a lot of time. I was looking at a study, Texas A&M Transportation Institute. They're saying by 2025, the time spent in traffic will increase to 62 hours. That's from that average of 54. National congestion costs will balloon. They say there's no silver bullet, but they do say that carpools, which we used to hear an awful lot about, public transportation and alternate modes of transportation can help. But this study also suggests that the big picture measures like adding capacity in these critical corridors and diversifying urban development are going to be needed. I mean, how do you really start looking at urban development? And in New York, do you see that where big projects that are coming online are taking into account the access, the egress to get to them? Or is that a secondary thought in some of these developments within the urban centers?
Well, I think too much of the emphasis has been build the housing because that's what people can see, or build the office building because, you know, you build out like the new office complex over at Hudson Yards on the far west side of Manhattan. Everybody can see it. but there's been a lot less thinking about how are all the new people going to get to and from home or to and from work. I mean, you presumably have people working and living in these new buildings, but we haven't kept up the public infrastructure so that they can get around. And I think that's really what has contributed to all of the delays and the lower performance the subway system has seen over the past half decade, that they've just been moving a record number of people around in the system. It makes it less robust to delays and breakdowns when it's this crowded. I think in the rest of the country, you know, particularly places like Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Texas, Arizona, they've just been thinking, oh, wow, we're growing, we're attracting population because of our cheap housing, because there's no one on the highways, there's no congestion. But by encouraging single-family, sub-development, housing development, they're just creating the new Los Angeleses of 20 years from now when, you know, you think, you know, Charleston is a paradise now, but building out in this way just condemns you to traffic in the future.
Oh, absolutely. You also point out in your writing that you're looking at taxis going about 4.7 miles an hour, which is a record low in modern times and 28% slower than in 2010. So this trend is something that is continuing unabated. Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry, for all of your thoughtful questions, and I look forward to seeing what your listeners think.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.